This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, good to be with you. I'm Joel Hilliker. The world is in a critical transition period. In many nations, politics are shifting dramatically. Discontented peoples want change. They're shoving aside the status quo, the political ideas and the mainstream political parties that have governed for generations. And they're turning to extreme parties. In some cases, they're turning away from democratic norms and embracing strongmen. We have a couple stories on today's program about this political tumult. First, we're going to look at Europe, particularly Germany. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer has a report about the rise of extreme parties. There's a familiar pattern playing out in several European countries. The most recent example was in Spain, which had a stunning election this past weekend. The country is deeply divided between right and left. There's tremendous instability, and it's really benefiting the far right. All of these events point back to the sequence of events that led to the rise of the Nazi Party in 1933. And looking at that history gives tremendous insight into what's happening now, and it does align perfectly with biblical prophecy. In Latin America, mass protests are filling the streets in several nations. Discontent is rampant. And what's happening there is that governments are cracking down. They're using strong-handed tactics to stamp out this dissent. Latin America has a long history of dictatorships and military juntas. Conditions there are setting these countries up to return to those kinds of tyrannical governments. When you look at this trend in light of Bible prophecy, you see it actually aligns with what's happening in Europe. So we're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Latin America. We also have a report from Jeremiah Jacques about China's military advancement. A new report from the U.S. Department of Defense shows just how rapidly China is progressing in advanced military technology, like aircraft carriers, stealth fighters, anti-satellite weapons, drones, cyber attack technology. There are a lot of reasons to be concerned about China's growing economic and political power. This shows that they're backing that up in an impressive way with military might. And I'll conclude the program by talking about an important principle of leadership that amid all these questions about politics and governments, far too many people are overlooking. We'll begin, though, with a look at this trend playing out in Europe in this report from Richard Palmer.
On this day in 1933, a vicious cycle came to an end. Germany held its final election before World War II. The Nazi Party won 92% of the vote, which is hardly surprising because they were the only party that was allowed to run. A process that began with inconclusive elections in 1928 ended with a Nazi dictatorship 5 years later. What is perhaps more surprising is that Europe is clearly and provably on the same path today. You can look back at the rise of the Nazis and see fringe parties rising all across Europe in exactly the same way. Now, here's the pattern. An economic crisis hits. This causes people to start to lose faith in established political parties. The mainstream consensus got it wrong in a lot of people's views, and so a few start supporting more extreme parties. This initial relatively minor shift in support means that the mainstream parties can't get a majority anymore. The mainstream right, for example, well, now they've got to either form a coalition with an extreme party, or they've got to reach out to their opponent on the mainstream left. And then the death spiral kicks in. You know, they reach out to the left. You have a left-right coalition that struggles to do anything of any significance. The two sides fundamentally disagree. The government's incapable of taking any bold action. It draws the mainstream parties together towards the center. And more voters reject the mainstream and embrace the extreme. Or, if the extreme is brought into the government, the fringe parties normalized, voters that would have once been put off by their extreme status now embrace them, and either way, the fringe grows in power. Their growth in power makes it even harder to form stable coalitions. Problems get worse. Coalitions get more unstable. Support for the extreme grows. That's what happened in 1930s Germany. In 1928, the Nazi Party came ninth in the German election with only 2.6% of the vote. The communists did four times better with 10.6%. But that level of support for these extreme parties was enough to start the spiral. Nobody could form a stable coalition. A grand left-right coalition got together and barely lasted 2 years before falling apart. And then in the next election, the fringe did much better. The National Socialists, 18% of the vote. Communists, 13%. And again, well, now it's even harder for anyone to have any kind of stable majority. For 2 years, Germany limped along with a parliament that had a minority government. Until fresh elections were held in July 1932. They solved nothing. Still no one could form a coalition. So they held elections again in November 1932. Support for the Nazi Party rose with almost every election. By the end, Adolf Hitler was powerful enough to take over, and the November 12, 1933 election cemented that. And the latest results, election results from Europe show that the continent is on the same path. Germany spent the last 6 years in a left-right coalition while support for mainstream parties has collapsed. After the last national elections in 2017, the coalition negotiations took so long that they set a new record. In the most recent local elections in Thuringia on October 27th, extreme parties gained the most votes. They gained most of the vote. Die Linke, or the left, the successor to East Germany's brutal communist regime, came in first place with 31% of the vote. The Alternative for Deutschland, the new far-right party, was in second place with 23.4%. One of these two has to be included in any coalition for that coalition to have a majority in the state parliament now. Meanwhile, Spain over the weekend showed that its politics have just about completely broken down. Their election results clearly follow the same death spiral that hit Germany. They held inconclusive elections in December 2015. No one managed to form a government. So new elections in June 2016. Politicians managed to cobble together a weak coalition. That fell in 2018. Again, another coalition rose up, limped along a little longer, until the nation held fresh elections in April this year. Again, no one could get together a government. So again, they held fresh elections, this time on Sunday. And still they have no clear coalition. There's no clear way forward. It's hard to see how Spain ever gets back from this point to having a functioning government. They're divided between left and right. They're also divided when it comes to its regions. They have a separatist movement. Some regions like Catalonia want to be independent. Some political parties want to clamp down on any kind of separation really hard and centralize power in Madrid. Others believe the best approach is to allow different regions a lot of local autonomy, so they don't want independence. So you've got the split between left and right, the split on the independence issue, and it's hard to see how any faction will be able to get a majority. The only clear victory in Spain is the far right. They entered Spain's parliament for the first time in its democratic history in the April election with 10% of the vote. This time, on Sunday's election, they've catapulted into third place, winning 15% of the vote, more than doubling their number of seats in Spain's Congress. These are just examples from Europe over the last few weeks. You go back longer and you see even more. In May, the European Parliament election showed the whole trend hitting all of Europe. And for decades, the European Parliament has been dominated by two political groupings: centre-right European People's Party, centre-left Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats. And combined, all the way back since 1979, they've controlled the majority of seats in that parliament. In May, they lost it for the first time. And you look at the breakdown in each country of those European elections. In France, Marine Le Pen's extreme right national rally beat the more mainstream party of President Emmanuel Macron. In Italy, the far right won by a landslide. Eastern Europe is full of governments that are right-wing, if not far-right, and many of them did well in the election. In Hungary, Viktor Orban's Fidesz won 52% of the vote, the only party in Europe to manage to win a majority. In Poland, the right-wing Law and Justice Party gained a very respectable 45%. Now, some experts are deeply alarmed by these trends. In the wake of Germany's local election, Charlotte Knobloch, the former president of the Central Council of Jews in Germany, said the AfD's success shows that our whole political system is coming apart at the seams. She said she is worried that so many support a party that has downplayed the horrors of the Nazi era, who are openly nationalistic, and have spread messages of hate against minorities, including the Jewish community. Christian Heubner, vice president of the International Auschwitz Committee, he sounded a similar warning. He said, for survivors of German concentration camps, this massive increase in votes for the AfD in Thuringia is another menacing signal that right-wing extremist attitudes and tendencies are consolidating in Germany. Political scientist and commentator Werner Patzel, he told the local, the last time we saw something of this kind in Germany was in the Weimar Republic, where political life was polarized between the communists and the National Socialists. This is quite uncommon. Then just in the last week, geopolitics expert Robert Kagan, The Spiegel, published an interview with him. And he said that for Germany to become a major military power right now is a big gamble. He warned that the fate of democracy as a common European ideology is now in question. One of the most important elements of the European project after World War II has been the suppression and control of nationalism, he said. And now, we are seeing nationalism returning. Spiegel asked him, do you really think there's a danger of Germany once again becoming a threat to its neighbors? Kagan made clear that he thinks there is. I think you really have to be an unwavering optimist to believe that Europe can stay stable and peaceful without the support of the United States, he said. You cannot compare the EU of the late 1990s to the EU of today. Europe is changing before your eyes, and more should be alarmed about it. It's changing in the same way that it changed back in the 1920s and the 1930s. This is one of the key trends that we've been watching here at The Trumpet. One of the most important, you can go all the way back to some of the very early Trumpet issues, all the way in 1991. And we're writing about this because of Bible prophecy. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21, for example, tells us to watch for the arrival of a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Mr. Flurry, writing about this verse, wrote that, in other words, a deceived public or group of European leaders likely invites this man into power. Current conditions in Europe, including the refugee crisis, the turmoil in German politics, provide probably one of the greatest opportunities ever for a new leader to come into power by flatteries. Chancellor Angela Merkel is on her way out and is now a lame duck. Expect political and social crises in Germany and Europe and public resentment and anger to grow even deeper. Then, watch for a strong man to take advantage and make his way to power through flatteries. You saw something similar happen all the way back in the 1930s, and we're walking right on down the same path today.
Thank you very much, Richard. So you focused on the similarities with what was happening in the years leading up to World War II, which is obviously very important to watch. In your view, what are some of the differences between what happened then and what we're seeing today?
Right. I think, yeah, there are some important differences. I think one big one is that it's unfolding more slowly today. You know, obviously 1927 to the beginning of the rise of these extreme parties until 1932, the Nazi government beginning 1933, you're looking at five and a half years. We had the financial crisis in 2008. We're 10 years on from that. And we don't have the Nazis.
Yeah.
So I think there's absolutely no question that this same process is unfolding, that every year the fringe parties are getting more and more votes. One of the big differences, it's unfolding more slowly. And I think part of that is because we have welfare states today. You know, when you have a big economic crisis, people lose their jobs. It's unpleasant. It's humiliating. But they don't starve. There's still a government that steps in there with welfare payments and that kind of thing. Now, these governments are massively in debt, and that's not going to be able to keep going forever. But I think that's slowed the trend. And then I think democracy is more established now than it was in the early 1930s. A lot of these countries had only been democracies for about a decade. When some of these trends started to kick in, they were just generally much more fragile. Whereas what we're seeing now is the unwinding of states that have been democratic for
Well, in Spain's case, I guess since the 70s, 80s, other states going all the way back to the 50s. So much more established states. And then also, I think it was one of those quotes that's often attributed to Mark Twain about history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. There sometimes are some important differences. And I think the fact that we're following in the pattern of the 1930s doesn't necessarily mean it's going to play out in an identical way, in that you have a fringe group ends up seizing power. I think if you look at Austria, for example, you find where Sebastian Kurz has kind of found a way out of the death spiral that we've been talking about, where you absolutely did have this trend in Austria until Kurz came along. And then he formed an alliance with the extreme right. He took a whole lot of their postures, a whole lot of their positions, all the while, though, still looking moderate, still looking reasonable, still looking like a very smooth politician. And in doing so, in the latest elections, he actually took a whole load of votes back from the extreme right. And he's about the only person in all of Europe that has been able to reverse, no one else has even been able to slow, let alone reverse the process. But he has. And so I think Europe's new nationalist figures could look a lot more like Kurz than Hitler.
Right. Well, I think it really, in a lot of ways, if you look at what has happened in Austria, it seems like there is a blueprint that you could see repeated elsewhere. When you look at the prophecies about, say, the strongman that's going to take over Germany, it definitely highlights the fact that he is a smooth operator, that he has charisma, that he doesn't have that kind of prickly Hitlerian kind of way about him. He's much more savvy and canny. And in some ways, it seems like it, just in talking about the differences that we see today from before, you would think that there would be a great number of Europeans who would explicitly reject anything that looked like what happened in the 1920s and 30s, but they would be comfortable with someone who maybe appropriated some of the ideals, but just went about it in a way that was far more palatable.
Right. I mean, the fact that you have got so many in Europe, even despite that history of the 1930s, being right, willing to embrace some of these extreme groups, in some ways makes the trend even more disturbing. But then, yeah, you're right. Absolutely. With that figure, if somebody can have the same message without the baggage, with that background, then you can see them being really appealing.
Very interesting. We appreciate that, Richard. We've been talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this alarming political trend taking place in several European nations. He wrote about this in his Trumpet Brief yesterday. The Trumpet Brief is a free email service we offer where you receive a message from one of the trumpet's writers analyzing an important event or trend in light of Bible prophecy. Go to thetrumpet.com. You can sign up for this free service. And while you're at it, check out Richard's article on this subject. Thanks so much, Richard.
Great to be Skyping with you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Mass protests are filling the streets in several nations throughout Latin America, and governments are cracking down to stamp out the dissent. The trend is reminiscent of Latin America's history of dictatorships and military juntas, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Rage is brewing across Latin America, in Chile, in Ecuador, and in Haiti. People are taking to the streets to protest income inequality and lack of economic opportunities. In Venezuela, in Nicaragua, and in Bolivia, people are taking to the streets to protest the socialist governments that their predecessors set up to tackle these same problems. And in Brazil, people are protesting the clear-cutting of the Amazon rainforest. Yet while the motivations behind the protests taking place in different nations are different, the government response to them has been very similar. To meet the threat of civil unrest, governments are turning to their militaries. Latin America used to be the land of the military junta. Now it is becoming the land of militarized democracies. The government of Chile deployed tanks and soldiers into the streets of Santiago to discourage further protests. And when Chilean President Sebastian Piñera went on television to extend Chile's state of emergency on October 21st, military officers surrounded him. 2 weeks earlier, Ecuadorians witnessed a similar scene. As demonstration against the nation's multi-billion dollar austerity program spiraled out of control, President Lenin Moreno appeared on television surrounded by a cabal of generals to impose a nationwide state of emergency. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro would likely have been ousted from power by protesters 5 years ago if it was not for the support he receives from Venezuela's military. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, tried to follow Maduro's example and deployed the Bolivian army against those protesting against election rigging. But the army turned against him last Sunday, forcing Morales to resign and call for fresh elections. Brazil has not relied on its military to quell dissent to the extent that many of its neighboring countries have. Yet one of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro's sons recently suggested that his father's government may have to adopt dictatorship-era tactics if they are deemed necessary to control street protest. Tactics such as stripping opposition lawmakers of political rights and suspending some constitutional guarantees. During the late 1970s, dictators ruled 17 out of 20 Latin American nations. Today, every Latin American nation except Cuba and Venezuela are considered democracies. But an increasing number of people yearn for a political strongman who can solve problems like corruption, crime, and inequality. According to the polling service Latino Barometro, only 48% of Latin Americans polled favored democracy over authoritarianism, while 28% said democracy is not necessarily preferable to authoritarianism. That's the highest percentage skeptical of democracy since 1995, when they began tracking this trend. People from the following nations were most likely to say that it does not matter whether a nation has a democratic government or not. El Salvador, 54%. Honduras, 41%. Brazil, 41%. Mexico, 38%. Panama, 34%. Guatemala, 34%. And the Dominican Republic, 29%. In Brazil, many people are even looking back with nostalgia to the time of the Holy Roman Empire. President Bolsonaro is advised on foreign policy by Prince Luiz of Orleans-Braganza, a royal descendant of both Holy Roman Emperor Francis II and Brazilian Emperor Pedro II. Braganza's uncle, Prince Bertrand, claims that Bolsonaro's election is the first step towards restoring the Brazilian monarchy, and roughly 11% of Brazilians would like to see this happen. Latin America and the world are headed for an age of strongmen. The Bible prophesies that 10 kings or dictators will partner with a false church and lend it their political and military power. The late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his classic book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, that these kings are 10 authoritarian leaders who will reign over a union of 10 European nations just before Jesus Christ's return. Roman Catholicism will be the ideological glue that binds these 10 nations together, and that religion will also bind many other nations to this empire. Latin America has the world's largest population of Catholics. The Holy Roman Empire colonized Brazil and the rest of Latin America in the 16th century, and based on these facts, Mr. Armstrong prophesied for decades that Europe would develop an increasingly powerful alliance with South America. The nations of Latin America will turn their back on American-style liberal democracy. They may even turn to some authoritarian leaders of their own, Cadillos with the power to carry out Europe's agenda in Latin America. Revelation 17 and Isaiah 47 refer to the power of the Holy Roman Empire. This power, known as Mystery Babylon the Great in Revelation, is referred to as the daughter of Babylon in Isaiah. And because God is wroth with the modern-day descendants of ancient Israel for their sins, he turns them over to this power. Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory wrote in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, Herbert Armstrong long prophesied, and we expect, the alliance between Europe and South America to grow extremely strong. The most significant factors that will cement this connection are religion and language. Roman Catholicism is the dominant religion of Latin America. But it will not be a union of equals. The Latin American countries will become vassal states to Europe. Anyone who knows the bloody history of the Holy Roman Empire knows why this is terrifying news for the near future. And the fact that less than half of Latin Americans favor democracy as the best form of government shows how easy it will be for this region to align itself with the authoritarian strongmen of the Holy Roman Empire.
Thank you very much, Andrew. The subject is so interesting. Watching the people in these countries who are recognizing the problems with democracy, the problems that so many nations are experiencing because of the unrest of the people, and different nations are handling this in different ways. But as you said, more and more of them are turning to strongmen, or strongmen are basically standing up and saying, this is the way that it's going to be in these countries. I feel like this, you know, Herbert Armstrong talked about the fact that man would have to form his own governments for this 6,000-year period, that we would govern ourselves. And we've tried a lot of different experiments in governance over that time. And so many of them are on trial and failing right now. And we're turning to this more kind of medieval style rule in a lot of these countries.
Right. You see that around the world in Asia. Africa never really had a great experience with democracy. But in Asia, you see nations turning away from it. In Latin America, you see nations turning away from it. And like I said, going back to forms of government that have tried and failed, but have failed long before living memory. And you'll see like a country like Latin America, that they're in the United States, you can have a very favorable view of democracy because our particular experience with it has been better than other forms of government that our ancestors lived under in Europe. Although in some nations like Latin America, you have a lot of people who just don't look favorably on it because they look back at the 1970s when most of the nations were run by dictators and there was less crime and less drug cartels. Mm-hmm. So it's your association with democracy is like, well, since the governments have gotten less authoritarian, you've had these dangerous criminal cartels and stuff taking over large parts of the country, trafficking drugs into the United States. They're like, this isn't working out. Let's maybe rewind the clock back. In some cases, they're saying cut back a couple decades to where military juntas were running the country, or like in the case of one in 10 Brazilians, they're like, no, let's just wind the clock back 150 years to when like I said, a descendant of the Holy Roman Emperors, Brazilian Emperor Dom Pedro II was in charge of things.
We've talked about the ideological alignment between Europe and Latin America. And of course, that prophecy that Latin America is actually going to come under the sway of Europe is the main driving factor that has led Herbert Armstrong and us in his footsteps to prophesy that's the way that it's going to go. Latin America and Europe are going to combine together, and basically they're Latin America coming under the domination of Europe. So seeing this taking place where these countries, the way that they're being governed, the people are kind of following in the same footsteps that we were talking earlier about with respect to Europe, the same strongman tendency. It's interesting. It's more than just economic considerations. It's more than just the alignment of religion between these two. It seems like there's a bigger mindset that is aligning between those people in these Latin American nations and those in Europe.
Right, because you've definitely got the language connection between, I mean, Spanish and Portuguese being the dominant languages down there. And then you've got the, even bigger than that, the religious connection. And then, like you were saying, that you've even got now like a just like a fundamental worldview of like how to run a nation. You've got like these populist leaders in Latin America and in Eastern Europe, and even starting to move into Western Europe, who definitely are not a favor of checks and balances. They want the power to get things done. I think it was Viktor Orban in Hungary who even said that he's like checks and balances is an American thing. He's like, that's not something we even want to do over here. And so that's, he's vocalizing a sentiment that's taking hold across Europe, but that sentiment is also taking hold across Latin America, like Bolsonaro's son saying that, well, maybe we do need to revive some of the dictatorship era tactics of stripping constitutional rights from opposition lawmakers if those lawmakers are fomenting unrest in the streets.
Quite amazing to see this unfolding the way that it is. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this political trend in Latin America moving away from democracy and toward strongman leadership. He's written an article called Latin America is About to Abandon Democracy. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
China has been growing in economic and political power so much that many say the coming century will be dominated by China. A new report from the U.S. Department of Defense shows they are backing that power up an impressive way with military might, as we'll now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Back in the 1970s, when the People's Republic of China launched its first nuclear-powered submarine, it became an object of worldwide derision. The submarine was comically loud, too noisy to evade most other nations' tracking systems. It also exposed its crewmen to dangerous levels of radiation, and it was unable to fire missiles while underwater. The submarine was basically a joke. And most of the rest of China's military at that time was similarly unimpressive. Throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, China kept spending more and more on its military, but its advances were slow, and its armaments lagged considerably behind those of global military powers in terms of both capability and reliability. Even well into the 2000s, China was generally viewed as a paper tiger, or perhaps a paper dragon. It appeared to be menacing because of its vast numbers of infantrymen and arms, but its actual military power was thin and comparatively primitive and ineffectual. But the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party were not deterred. They kept researching and developing and designing and building. They kept stealing technology from other nations and reverse engineering and mass producing it. They kept training and exercising with the militaries of more advanced nations, such as Russia. They kept advancing more and more tax revenue into their colossal military apparatus. And today, the People's Liberation Army is no longer a joke. Sinologists and military analysts around the world agree that China's military has arrived. Stealth fighters, drones, railguns, aircraft carriers, anti-satellite weaponry, cyber attack technology, and a huge and diverse array of ballistic missiles are all found in abundance in China's arsenals. And most all of these present serious concerns for military specialists around the globe, including those in the Pentagon. The Department of Defense's latest report on China, titled Military and Security Developments Involving the People's Republic, enumerates several specific aspects of the country's military modernization. It discusses China's array of short, medium, and long-range ballistic missiles. In the first category, the Chinese are believed to now have as many as 1,200, and in the intermediate range, they have some 300. The number of longer-range missiles is not published, but it is clear that this array includes precision-guided, nuclear-capable weapons that in many cases are able to strike American assets in the Pacific region. This includes U.S. bases in Japan and Guam. China also now has a number of road-mobile, nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles. The Pentagon report also draws attention to China's new hypersonic missiles that are thought to be able to evade even the world's most advanced shields, interceptors, and defense systems. Some of these may be capable of sending nuclear warheads all the way to the U.S. mainland. And then there are the ASATs. These are anti-satellite weapons, which experts believe are capable of compromising some of the space-based American assets that the U.S. military depends on so heavily for its eyes and ears and for communication. With China's surface-to-air missiles, we have in recent years seen them deployed to sensitive regions in the South China Sea. This is in order to position China to be able to enforce its increasingly ardent and zealous claims of owning nearly that entire sea. And it's not just with land-based surface-to-air missiles that China is militarizing the South China Sea and preparing to be able to defend it. There's been a major shift in the last few years away from China's decades-long focus on land power and toward a new focus on naval might. The Chinese Navy will have 350 vessels by 2020, and a handful of these are cutting-edge next-generation warships fitted with the most advanced weaponry and naval systems. The Chinese are also building their own aircraft carriers now, with the first completing its sea trials earlier this year and joining China's first carrier, the Soviet-made Leonine. And reports show that up to three others are now at various stages of construction. To go on these carriers, the Chinese are developing more and more aircraft. They have 2,200 operational aircraft at present, with 600 of those being considered modern. For the carriers, they have J-15 jets, as well as the fifth generation J-20s. J-31s are coming online soon, and they already have KJ-600s, which are fixed-wing airborne early warning and control aircraft. Analysts call these the aircraft that could help China's Navy rival America's. And then there are the new advanced destroyers. The Chinese have had the Type 055 destroyer in development since 2014. These are guided missile destroyers intended mainly to accompany aircraft carriers, and since they're designed with considerable versatility for long-range air defense and anti-surface, anti-air, and anti-submarine warfare, they give a major boost to China's naval capacity. The Chinese launched the first two Type 055s last year, so those are now charging through the testing phases and are expected to be transferred to the Navy toward the end of this year. And over the next several years, eight more of these will enter service. In recent years, China's Navy has also focused more and more on its amphibious assault ships. The PLA Navy has been adding a number of amphibs, each of which can carry 800 soldiers, 4 helicopters, and 20 armored vehicles. And the Navy has been focusing also on developing new frigates and equipping them with world-class anti-submarine capabilities. And it has worked on its submarines as well. The U.S. Defense Department's 2019 report on China's military power said the PLA Navy currently operates 4 nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines, 6 nuclear-powered attack submarines, and 50 conventionally powered attack submarines. This means China has more subs than any other nation, including the United States. And even though the capability of some of China's submarines still lags behind, they are being rapidly modernized. No one is laughing at China's submarines anymore. And really, no one is laughing at any part of China's military, particularly its naval might. China is no longer a paper tiger or a paper dragon. It is powerful and capable and bent on asserting its will far beyond its borders. An insightful analysis published by The Warrior Maven on Sunday said, quote, China's rapid development of new destroyers, amphibs, stealth fighters, and long-range weapons is quickly increasing its ability to threaten the United States and massively expand expeditionary military operations around the globe. The rapid modernization of China's military and its increasing ability to dominate the South China Sea is significant because it means the era of relative peace that the world has experienced for the last 75 years is approaching an abrupt end. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote about this in our July 2016 issue, contrasting China's power and ambition with the U.S.'s decline, and placing it all in the context of Bible prophecy. He wrote, quote, since Japan's defeat in World War II, America has protected the South China Sea, this vital trade route, and brought peace to this part of the world. But now, the American military is retreating and other great powers are coming in to fill the vacuum. China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It is forcing these countries to do it at once. Everything is headed in the direction of war. End quote. Mr. Fleury explained that his understanding of China and what its military modernization is leading to is based on Bible prophecy. In Deuteronomy 28:52, God warns the nations of Israel that he will transfer control over the world's strategic sea gates to their enemies if they reject him and if they rebel against his law. Mr. Fleury explained that this is, quote, a prophecy for the modern-day descendants of Israel, which mainly means America and Britain. Today we see China's military becoming a fierce and formidable force, and we see it using its naval might to assert control over the South China Sea and the sea gates that allow access to that sea. This is happening in locations that just a few short years ago were under the control of the U.S. and Britain, but now these gates are in China's hands, which shows that this prophecy in Deuteronomy is in the process of being fulfilled. Today's news is fulfilling ancient biblical prophecies, specific prophecies. And the scriptures show in passages such as Matthew 24:21 through 22 and Daniel 12:1 that this is leading to a time of unprecedented world war. But there's also great cause for hope that's tied to these trends because they show that God is working to reach the world so that he can finally get through to the rebellious people and teach them to love his way of peace and to know and to love him. And he's doing this so that he can bring a decisive end to mankind's suffering. Mr. Fleury concludes his article writing, quote, all this prophesied destruction is what it will take for God to reach this world. After this, people will be ashamed, and they will get to know God. Yes, there's a lot of bad news when you consider what it takes to get people to the point of knowing God, but ultimately, the outcome is spectacularly good news.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. It's amazing to look at this this overall picture. I think the way that you were talking about just the history of China at the beginning there is quite fascinating, and seeing how China has been growing in its power over such a long period. They're advancing on several fronts. Obviously, we've talked a lot about just their economic advancements. We see their political power growing in a lot of ways. But they really seem to have an admirable ability to keep the big picture and to play the long game. Maybe you can just talk about that a bit, just the Chinese mindset as they're pursuing these aims.
Sure, yes. Well, their basic goal for the last several centuries, really, has been to assert domination not just over the South China Sea, but really over all of Asia and eventually the world. China, the name of the country, if you look at it in Chinese, it translates to the Middle Kingdom. They view themselves as the center of the world, the middle of the world, the focal point, the real seat of power and authority. And, you know, since the British Empire rose, China really suffered what they call the century of humiliation at the hands of the British and the French. And ever since 1949, especially when the Communist Party won the Chinese Civil War, their main ambition has been to undo that century of humiliation and to once again come to be, you know, rulers over Asia, what they see as their rightful place in Asia and the world, and just to become the hegemons there, regionally and globally. So all of this economic increase that we've seen, this political centralization that we've seen under the Chinese Communist Party, and this focus on military might, and especially in the last 5 to 10 years on naval might, which allows them to go far beyond their borders, it's all designed to work toward that overarching goal.
So you mentioned the South China Sea, and that's one particular military objective that we've talked quite a bit about, being able to control that very strategic trade route. Can you just give us any more examples of the way that China is actually using these weapons and these advanced capabilities and the geopolitical goals that it's forwarding?
Yes. Well, we've spoken on the show several times about the artificial islands that China has built in the South China Sea. There are 7 of those now that are militarized, meaning they're equipped with landing strips for aircraft, with surface-to-air missile systems in some cases, including the Russian-made S-400 missile system, which virtually doubles the range of China's existing capabilities in some ways. And so with these military outposts, they effectively have unsinkable aircraft carriers, what you could view these islands as being unsinkable aircraft carriers. And with these, they're dominating more and more of the South China Sea. This is a trade route that has roughly 1/3 of the world's total maritime commerce flows through it. Japan depends heavily on imports, particularly of raw materials, oil from the Middle East, to go through the South China Sea. And then Japan has virtually no economy if they can't export back through that sea to sell their finished goods to Europe and to the U.S. So it's 1/3 of total maritime commerce. If China could clamp down on that, it would really rattle the global economy, just be unbelievably dramatic.
So they do have a lot of investments that increasing investments, say, in Africa, in South America. We've talked about those. How much, say, is its increasing military being used to secure those investments?
In Africa, we see it quite a bit. In Djibouti, China has recently opened up its very first overseas military base. And that's also just miles away from the U.S.'s last African military base, Camp Le Monnier there. And so part of that is about China being able to militarily secure the economic investments that it has, not just in Djibouti, but throughout much of East Africa there. Mm-hmm. And in Latin America, there have been fewer really militaristically obvious ambitions such as that, but they are, I think, positioning themselves to be able to quickly build such bases. Mm.
Fascinating stuff. We appreciate that very much, Jeremiah. We've been talking to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about China's advancing military. He's working on an article about this that you can watch for on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
The world is very divided right now over what makes for a good leader. The U.S. House of Representatives is gearing up to impeach the president. There's a lot of high-minded talk about how he's unfit for office because he lacks presidential temperament or that he's using the power of his office immorally. These very same leaders have looked on abuses of power that are even worse within their own party, and they've thought that was fine. Gaining and holding power is really the prevailing political consideration. In many countries right now, there's a churning, convulsing struggle over leadership, swirling through the conscience of the peoples. And the central question is, who will be the best leader? And in case after case, individual character doesn't really factor in. People aren't concerned about whether the leader exemplifies qualities like honesty, sincerity, moral uprightness, marital fidelity, those types of considerations. Many people believe that corruption is endemic in the system. And in some ways, they'd prefer a leader who, quote, knows how to play the game. The Bible discusses the qualities required of leaders. Leaders in families, in cities, in nations. And, it almost completely ignores job creation, policy sophistication, even military administration, it almost completely focuses on one thing, personal character. In so many countries, questions of character are pushed aside in favor of the qualifications that, quote, really matter. But the Bible says personal character is the qualification that really matters. It says that the foundation of true leadership is the ability to lead yourself. So many of those in authority have never learned this fundamental character principle, and as a result, they're making a mess of this world. Proverbs 25:28 says, "He that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls." So this is where leadership has to start. It starts with ruling your own spirit. You must govern yourself. Millions of people today believe that weak personal character has nothing to do with a leader's success. God knows that weak character disqualifies someone from high office. If a man can't rule himself, how can he rule others? As Jesus said, if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. To a young man who's looking ahead to having a family and forging a career and taking his place as a contributor to society, a builder of society, what was the Apostle Paul's advice? He said in Titus 2, urge the younger men to control themselves. Or the Moffat translation says, tell the young men to be masters of themselves at all points. A person who lacks self-control makes himself unfit to lead in many ways. He caves into peer pressure easily. He's too concerned about what others think of him. He prioritizes appearance over substance. And that leads to forms of cheating and corner cutting. He's susceptible to unsound judgment, favoritism, partiality, unpredictability. He wrestles with feelings of depression and inferiority. He gets jealous easily, especially when someone around him succeeds. He can become terribly manipulative and political. He loses his temper. He acts arrogantly, even tyrannically, to mask his insecurities. He's self-destructive and succumbs to bad influences. He has difficulty controlling his own passions and lusts. The more authority such a person has, the more damage he can do to more people. Someone who truly conquers himself and successfully administers his own self-rule can successfully take on more and more authority and do more and more good for more and more people. Proverbs 16:32 says, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. If you're faithful in small matters, Jesus Christ said, you'll be faithful in the big ones. So learn to truly govern yourself. Then you can influence your family, your country, your world. It will begin unlocking your potential for leadership and genuine success. Notice Proverbs 20 and verse 28 about godly leadership. Mercy and truth preserve the king, and by loving kindness he upholds his throne. The word loving kindness can mean good deeds or kindnesses. Truth refers to trustworthiness. The Living Bible renders this verse, if a king is kind, honest, and fair, his kingdom stands secure. Now, if you asked 100 world leaders to list the most important qualities contributing to the longevity of an administration or a kingdom, how many would mention honesty or loving kindness? The fact is, the Bible trains us in a different type of government, a government that works. God isn't calling the governors of this world, who with all their expertise and all their experience, they can't solve problems, they can't make people's lives better, they can't successfully enact policies of defense or economics. But if you want to learn to build a government that works, study the scriptural instruction that God outlines in 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1. These individuals are leaders who rule themselves by submitting to God. Then they rule over those who follow them by serving. Yes, these qualifications for leadership are vastly different than those that you see in the world today, but so are the results. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Lance Morrow. Leaders make things possible. Exceptional leaders make them inevitable. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.